Just as the automobile transformed the lives of Americans 100 years ago, so the smartphone is having the same effect on the country of India. That's the view of Ravi Agrawal, managing editor of Foreign Policy and author of India Connected, How the Smartphone is Transforming the World's Largest Democracy. On a recent cold winter's day, Ravi joined me by phone to discuss his book, reflect on the smartphone phenomena, and contemplate the social and political implications of this all-powerful handheld device. Smartphone sales may be slowing globally, but not in India. It's the second largest phone market in the world after China, with over 430 million users. And still, that only accounts for 45% of the addressable market. In other words, while demand for smartphones in most parts of the world are slowing, the appetite in India is accelerating. Last year, the overall market grew by 10%, and it's on pace for another double-digit turnout this year. Like flies to honey, global smartphone manufacturers are circling, and no group has done better than Chinese manufacturers with a combined 60% share of the India smartphone market. That's a phenomenal showing, particularly for Beijing-based Xiaomi. The company started making phones just 7 years ago, and today it's India's top seller. To grasp the significance of the meteoric growth of smartphones in India, I asked Ravi to put things in context. What does it mean now, and what could it mean in a few years' time when smartphones become ubiquitous?
The main thing to look at is that, you know, the smartphone is transforming India in a variety of ways, more so than almost any other place on Earth. And the reason is that if you look at how the West adapted to the Internet, it was an evolution. So you look at any Western country, say America, for example, and people had PCs and telephone landlines, and so therefore they got dial-up connections to the Internet, and then they evolved with that to cable and DSL, and then they got routers and Wi-Fi, and then finally, after all of that, they got phones that had 3G and then smartphones and 4G. So it was an evolutionary process of how they engaged with computers, but also the Internet. India has had less of an evolution unless you're rich and urban. And it has had more of a revolution where hundreds of millions of people are getting online in a short span of just a few years, mostly through smartphones. And these are smartphones that are very cheap, that are easily accessible, that come with cheaper data plans, and that are allowing to get millions of Indians online in a way that they wouldn't have been able to before. And the reason is that for most Indians, the smartphone is their first PC and will be the only PC they'll ever have. It is their first camera. It is often their first screen. It is often their first Walkman and MP3 player. So you take all of those things together, the first mapping device and the first overall communicating device. You put it all together and you explore, you know, what could this mean for a country like India where average age is 27, average income is less than $2,000 a year, and you've got this device that is transformative in so many ways. What does it do? What does it do to a country of India's size? That's what the book is about.
And what is the average monthly cost to own and operate a smartphone?
Well, it depends on the price of the smartphone you buy. Mm. So if we begin with data plans, which are more sort of democratic in that sense. You can have a pay-as-you-go plan for as little as, you know, a couple of dollars, U.S. dollars a month. You can spend much more and get more data. But data in India has now gotten really cheap, especially with the recent arrival of a company called Reliance Jio, which for the first 6 months of its launch offered people the internet for free. And this is fast 4G internet. So data is fairly cheap, even by global standards. The devices themselves have gotten much cheaper. So again, Reliance Jio leases out a phone for as little as $23 for 3 years. You can buy phones from Chinese makers like Oppo and Xiaomi and Huawei for anywhere from $100 to $300. There are Indian smartphone makers like Micromax that also manufacture very cheap smartphones. So the barrier to entry is lower than it has ever been.
Mm.
And that's not taking into account the market for hand-me-downs.
And how pervasive is the majority of Indians now have an own and operate a smartphone?
It's not yet a majority. So Most Indians are certainly on cellular phones, basic feature phones that may not have advanced screens and cameras. Mm. But when it comes to smartphones, the number is somewhere in the 400 million range, which leads to about 500 million Indians on the internet right now. And to give you a sense of how much of a leap forward that is, in the year 2000, only 20 million Indians were online. This was the PC and dial-up connection era. By 2010, 100 million Indians were online. And then that tripled to 300 million by 2015. And now we're well past 500 million, 500 million. And, you know, it's expected that India will cross 750 million, 800 million by about 2025 or so. Inching up closer towards a billion by 2030. So that's a lot of people getting online in a very short space of time. None of this would have been possible were it not for the smartphone.
Robbie, what does that do to a society going from zero to 100 like that? I mean, what kinds of positive and negative effects are you seeing? Maybe you could share a few examples.
Sure. And before we even get to the examples, I should say we don't know what the effects are because they're playing out live in front of our eyes. So this is very much a developing story. But if we were to take an analogy of something similar that's happened somewhere else in the past, the analogy that I like to use is that of the car and the United States of America in the early 20th century. And so when the Americans invented the car, they ended up building roads and highways and the interstate system. That, of course, ended up creating tens of thousands of jobs, you know, for a country that was just emerging out of the Depression. And then with that came the creation of suburbia, and then you've got the picket-fenced home. And then with all of that, you build the commute. So you have a commute to work, and then on the way to the commute, you need the gas stations and the McDonald's and the drive-in restaurants, and you've got the multiplexes and the movie theaters, and that's just physical infrastructure and the parking garages. And then you add in the cultural infrastructure that America created in terms of how the car was enshrined in society and enshrined in Hollywood. You think of the race and the chase and how the car embodied freedom for a generation of Americans. You take all of those things together, how the car was the literal embodiment of the American dream, and transpose it to India, and ask the question whether India and the smartphone could be the embodiment of the Indian dream for a generation of young, hungry, mostly rural Indians who have long yearned for a way to be more efficient, for a way to have the tools of the modern economy to engage with the world. Mm. So that's just an example of, you know, how big this could be in so many different ways.
So a modern icon, something that everyone rallies around, understands, and can share in its possibilities and its risks.
Exactly. Something that becomes defining for a generation, for society, because of what it embodies. And it embodies more than just a physical device. For many young Indians, the phone will be their first private property. It will be their first payments device. Certainly their first credit card will come through a phone, likely through an account on Paytm, which is the Indian version of PayPal. The phone will be their first camera. You know, and so for all of those reasons, the phone becomes an embodiment of their hope and their dreams and their aspirations. And of course, for a country of India's size, hope and aspiration is very important. And it's something that can serve it very well if all works out well. It is also something that can backfire quite spectacularly if aspirations are raised too high and reality doesn't deliver.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest this episode is Ravi Agrawal, New York and Washington, D.C.-based managing editor of Foreign Policy and author of India Connected, How the Smartphone is Transforming the World's Largest Democracy. For all the benefits of smartphone ownership, this $400 to $600 device is also a gateway to a world of information, not all positive or even helpful. In the second part of our conversation, I ask Ravi if the smartphone as portal to the World Wide Web has the potential to disrupt some of the cultural constructs that hold India together. Could the smartphone have dilatory effects on India's social sensibilities?
Easily. There are so many different things on that front. I mean, take, for example, pornography. Pornography has never been something that was easily accessible in India in a mass way, certainly not for children or teenagers. Today, with a smartphone, it's very easy for an Indian to type in the name of a porn star and be able to find pornography or violent pornography. In fact, the most Googled person in India is not a Bollywood star, it is not the Prime Minister of India, it is not a cricket star, it is a former porn star. her name is Sunny Leone. She's now an actress, so I guess she is a Bollywood star of sorts. But, you know, there's an immense amount of curiosity about things that have been restricted in the past. And porn is just one of those things, which can have a range of deleterious effects. And I'm not one to moralize about pornography. I think, you know, if people want to watch it, they can and they should. But you need to be sensitized. You need to know how to deal with it. And, you know, if you're a 12-year-old boy with no way of really discussing sex and sexuality, and you've never seen the female body before, you know, then, and if this is your first exposure to sexuality, then it can be quite dangerous. There are studies that are beginning to point to links between rape and violent rape in India, but they're still quite inconclusive. But that's just one aspect of potentially deleterious effects. I mean, there's fake news, of course, which we can get into in some more length, and there's addiction. An entire generation of Indians are going to get addicted to their phones in ways that I don't think they've begun to realize how damaging it can be. In the West, for example, we're just beginning to discover studies showing pretty clearly that excessive smartphone use can be damaging to the brain, that excessive use of social media can make people depressed. It can make them more likely to commit suicide even, especially among American teens. All of those things will be very possible in India as well. And that's something that hasn't begun to be debated at a national level. And certainly there are deleterious effects that will be seen across the country quite soon.
Well, just as you see this escalation in access and use of smartphones in such a short period of time, and they've leapfrogged, as you've pointed out, could it be that there's an opportunity here to get across some of the more social or psychological issues that have only recently risen in communities in the West or in more developed markets? And in other words, are there studies or are there factions within India that are resisting the adaptation or the ownership and use of smartphones?
Very few, to be honest. The only people who are resisting smartphones in India tend to be rural village male elders who would prefer that women in their villages have no access to phones and no access to the internet. So in that sense, the smartphone is a tool, because it's a tool for freedom, it is a freedom that is sometimes restricted in parts of India. And so unsurprisingly, you know, in India's villages, 9 out of 10 internet users are male, only one is female. And an example of how, you know, the phone itself has been restricted for many, many years. And this predates the smartphone going back to the regular cellular phone. So those tend to be the people who would restrict the use of the smartphone. But by and large, I should make clear, it's more of a Western concern when it comes to the deleterious impacts of the phone. By and large, in India, if you were to go there today, and speak to a wide swath of people in urban and rural India, most people are going to be quite positive about the phone because, you know, for them, again, this is quite new. The phone is quite a new technology, and it brings with it quite a new world of other technologies and the internet. And so there's still a lot of optimism about that.
Well, in India, the largest democracy in the world, Ravi, I mean, it, you know, what are some of the concerns among the political elite who now see the smartphone as a tool for people to get informed or misinformed quite easily?
Well, and that's fake news right there. I mean, that's exactly what the larger political concern is and the civil society concern is. And that's that, you know, when people aren't sensitized to using the internet, and they can be, they have a history, a cultural history of believing in superstitions, for example, they can be more gullible to either fake news or maliciously planted news. that just moves very quickly on social media. You know, to give you an example, 15 years ago in the West, people, you know, who just started using the internet and had a Hotmail account would start getting chain mails, you know, the type of mail you get when it says, if you don't forward this to 10 people, you'll be unlucky in love. And you do it once or twice until someone says, hey, that's really stupid, you shouldn't do that, and then you stop doing that. Well, you know, that was an evolutionary process of learning how to deal with chain mail and forwards and fake news. In India, you've got hundreds of millions of people who are going through that process in one go, and they're making mistakes. And so it's quite common in India for fake news to spread like wildfire on social media. And that is an issue of immense concern for, you know, for security, for safety, you know, for mob violence, for swinging an election, if it's fake news about politics. The potential ramifications are immense and really worrying.
You know, it's a matter of education and sophistication as well. I remember I spent about a year in India in the early 1980s down in Chennai. And I remember Bollywood stars rolling into town who might have played the role of Shiva, you know, in a film. And all of a sudden they appear, enter the political scene, and they're declared as incarnations. And, you know, wouldn't you know, they're elected and they go on to be terrible politicians. I mean, there is something to be said about, you know, a certain level of education in a vast democracy. And you can see how the phone could either feed and fuel that problem, or it could, you know, emancipate it and maybe turn it around to some degree. I guess it depends on how it's used and where it's used.
Exactly. And in that sense, the phone is really no different than electricity or the car or, you know, other great inventions that have changed the world. They are tools that can be used for good and for bad, which is not to say that you want to take them away from anyone ever, because really people want choice and they want the ability to shape their own destiny. And there is nothing like the smartphone that could sort of move the needle in India, as it were. And so, you know, if you read my book, you'll see that I see the smartphone as a massive agent of change and a catalyst for other changes that were already underway. So some of this will be good and some of the impacts will be bad. And you just have to deal with them as they come along, especially with the bad stuff. You have to be nimble and ready to educate people and focus on digital literacy. Think of it this way. When the car became a mainstream product, governments around the world and car companies began to invest quite heavily in campaigns to educate people to A, not drink and drive, and B, to wear their seatbelts. Hmm. Those were essential campaigns, because while the car is a clear tool of productivity and efficiency and, you know, important for global commerce, it is also a weapon of mass destruction if used in the wrong way.
Right.
The phone is no different if you think about it. The phone is an immense tool for productivity and efficiency. And, you know, the maps will save Indians, you know, millions of hours of time. Google searches can save you visits to a library. Mm-hmm. Paying a bill online can save you hours of your time. Those are just a few examples of the ways in which smartphones, especially in an Indian context, can be a massive boon for the lives of regular Indians. But, you know, given what we know about the ways in which it can be misused, given what we know about the ways in which it can be harmful to the human brain if used in excess, that's where it's really important for the government, but also for smartphone companies and data companies, to be upfront and honest about, you know, how much is too much. And so, you know, one of the things that I've often called for in India is you know, more public awareness campaigns about addiction, about excessive use of smartphones, about fake news. And just as companies invest so much money in advertising, it wouldn't cost that much for them to add, you know, literature, for example, multilingual literature in each sort of smartphone packet. To just explain, here are some of the things you need to know about what you're using.
Warning labels.
Software.
Yeah, warning labels like, yeah, cancer-causing. If it's a pack of cigarettes, this could be an addictive product. Do you think anybody will fold to that, or the government is in a position to push back on the telecom providers to get something like that through?
I don't know. I mean, that's likely going to be, there'll be a massive push and pull there between the regulators, the government, and companies.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Ravi Agrawal, managing editor of Foreign Policy and author of India Connected. More in a moment. I'm Steve Stein, and my guest is Ravi Agrawal, managing editor of Foreign Policy and CNN's former New Delhi bureau chief. Ravi has spent a life observing Indian transition, and more than any technology exposure to date, the smartphone, so he believes, holds promise of transforming the country for better or for worse. If the smartphone is the weapon, data is the warlord, and in India, all bets are off as to how effectively and ethically the country and those with access to data will use it to elevate or undermine the user.
The concerns about data in India are still concerns that are held by, you know, more of a smaller, educated, urban group of people, which is to say that it's a fairly small percentage of India's internet population. That's not to say that those concerns aren't valid or that those concerns shouldn't be shared by everyone else. They should. And so, you know, I think the concerns about data are concerns on several fronts. One is that, you know, Facebook has more users in India than any other country on earth. WhatsApp has more users in India than any other country on earth. So, you know, Indians are already giving up their data in ways that they may not be fully aware of. Indians obviously use Google in large numbers. So that's another way in which they're being, you know, they're handing over data to Gmail or to Google in ways that they may not fully be aware of. Many Indians use Chinese-made smartphones, so there could easily be national security concerns there and whether that information is then being passed on to the Chinese state or not, we don't know. But then the third aspect of all of this is the fact that more than a billion Indians have signed up for a biometric ID system, which is called Aadhaar.
Explain that.
And
yeah.
So the Aadhaar system was set up a few years ago as a way for Indians to have one form of ID, you know, because many Indians never had any form of ID, no driving license, no ration card, and certainly no passport. And so the notion of having one sort of computer-generated ID which takes in your fingerprints and your retinal scans and your name is a way for you to be able to say, I am me. And in that sense, it's a very important thing for India because the successful implementation of the system of Aadhaar could mean that it makes it easier for people to open bank accounts. It could mean that it's easier for the government to hand out subsidies to people. It could mean that people are able to better do business with each other, to sign up for services. So there are a lot of good things that would come with Aadhaar and will come with Aadhaar. But the downside is the fact that there's all this data now which exists on government databases, and they could easily be misused if they were hacked or if they were leaked. And there are clear instances of data from this database being leaked. So there are increasing fears and concerns about what this means for data in India moving forward. All of that said, I should point out that Aadhaar's data is nowhere near as smart as the data that, say, Facebook or Google may have. And the reason is that all Aadhaar really has is your name, address, and your vitals, so your fingerprints and your retinal scans, which are important things. You can't change them. But it doesn't have your browsing behavior. It doesn't have a history of your searches. So it's not able to advertise to you in any meaningful way. It's a government product. It's not a corporate product.
Is there any plan to evolve what data is collected and monitored and managed? Or is this the beginning and end of the program just to make sure they capture and uniquely identify every individual user?
My understanding is that the scope of the program was to uniquely identify, and that's that. The current government tried to make it mandatory to have an Aadhaar account to open a bank account, for example, or to get a cell phone number. But the Supreme Court of India ruled that it was not mandatory to have an Aadhaar account to get a bank account. So in doing so, the Supreme Court has ensured that people who have concerns about data are able to opt out of the system, which I think is an important victory for choice in India.
Tell me, Ravi, what are some of the unique applications that are evolving in India with access to smartphones?
Well, there are many applications that are, you know, if not unique to India, then Indians use them in unique ways. For example, you know, we all know Uber in the West, and in part, it's great because you don't have to pay cash or swipe a card when you finish your ride. But in India, it's quite the opposite, because a majority of Uber's rides, as well as its competitor Ola, Ola's rides, are paid for in cash at the end of a ride. And that's because Indians prefer to pay in cash. They seem to have a strange mistrust of the system, or a mistrust in credit card companies, for example, or maybe they're sitting on black money, and which is untaxed income, and they want to get rid of their cash. It could be any of those reasons, but it's quite widespread. So Amazon's big competitor in India, Flipkart, it began its services in India many years ago with a cash-on-delivery model. So you could order a book online, and someone would show up at your doorstep with the book, and then you would pay them for the book in cash. So there are strange ways in which Indians use these modern technologies, and that has a lot to do with how Indians think and their own systems and their own ways in which what they trust and what they don't trust. Yep. I mean, to give you another example, you know, in the West, especially in America, most people use single SIM cell phones or smartphones. Most Indians use dual SIM smartphones. They just like the ability to be able to hopscotch from one provider to another, in part because service is spotty, so they like to hedge their bets. The other example on that front is that, again, in America, it's more likely that people will have a monthly contract with their cellular provider. In India, it's more likely that people will follow a pay-as-you-go model, so no contracts, and they're able to sort of cut the cord whenever they'd like. And the reason, again, is trust, because they may not necessarily trust the company to give them continually good service, so they like the option of switching from time to time. And it works both ways, because big companies may also not trust the Indian consumer to pay up on a monthly basis, because they may not have good credit. So, you know, a lack of trust is, and this is something I delve into in great detail in India Connected through the course of a book, a lack of trust is really a good way to understand why some of the things that don't seem to work don't work in India, and why Indians act the way they do in business.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, just to go back to that digital versus hard currency point you just made, in India, it's been wildly successful where, you know, every grandmother on a street corner selling vegetables will give you a, you know, an opportunity to use your smartphone to pay. And it's pervasive. In fact, it's probably the fastest moving digital transaction country in the world. Yet it sounds like in India, it's quite the opposite. With all of the currency issues and the devaluation earlier in the year and some other, you know, political maneuvering, wouldn't a digital payments or micropayments option be a comfort to people who might worry about these things?
I think it will, but it still takes time to move on from cash. You still need to make that mental transition to being able to imagine cash as something that is digital, be it through a credit card or be it digital payments. But what is clear is that, you know, India is moving towards digital payments, and in doing so, it is leapfrogging credit cards. So, you know, digital wallet companies like Paytm, which I had mentioned earlier, or other companies in India, Google has its own wallet in India, WhatsApp is trying to get into the payments business in India as well. You know, all of these companies see immense growth in India for small transactions conducted digitally. And it's only natural that that would happen as Indians, A, get online in greater numbers, and B, build more trust in the system, in a new digital system.
Mm.
So it takes time, but once they cross that sort of inertia line of being able to trust, I think it'll move very quickly.
Yeah, you see moves by the Chinese. I mean, Jack Ma, you know, flew into Africa about 6 months ago to make a big pitch across that continent for Alipay as, you know, almost a giveaway digital payments gateway for with the same rationale. The credit card, aspects had not come into play yet. Still a cash-based society. Lots of people were owning and buying smartphones. It seemed to present an opportunity. Do you see the Chinese moving into India and looking for similar opportunities there?
Well, so Africa in general and India are fairly similar in terms of where they are in terms of development, income levels, average age, ability to leapfrog, and all of those things. So they're similar markets. Of course, India, the difference being is one market, and Africa is a market of many, many countries. So China has already entered India in a significant way. The biggest smartphone manufacturer in India today is a Chinese smartphone maker. In fact, in the last quarter, four of the biggest five smartphone manufacturers were all Chinese.
Mm.
So there's no doubt that the Chinese have already made significant inroads into the Indian market when it comes to hardware. Software is a little bit different. There's the obvious language barrier. But outside of that, you know, the Chinese internet is, you know, more of an ecosystem sort of model where you can enter the world of WeChat and do many things all at once. You can transact, you can chat, you can book a taxi and, you know, get a meal and all of those things in one. India's is more fractured, and that's in large part because of India's significant English-speaking population, around about 200 million Indians. India's long adopted Western ways of using the internet before other countries have. So, you know, Google is a very significant player in India. So is Uber. So is Amazon. You know, Apple less so. But all of these companies already have significant presences in India. And so it's less likely that Chinese software would be able to make giant inroads into an Indian market that is already competitive with Western players and Indian players.
Ravi, would you say that singularly this access to smartphones in the last several years is one of the greatest single moves forward in Indian society that anything you've seen in the last 40, 50 years? How big is this?
I think it's the biggest.
Mm.
And I wrote the book on this, so I'm going to put my money where my book is. And I think this will end up being, this being the smartphone, will end up being the most transformative single thing in India's modern history, since India became an independent country. You could say that electricity had a big impact. You could say that India's 1991 economic reforms had a significant impact, and they all did. But all of them also left behind enough Indians. What makes the smartphone so transformative for India today is that it is very cheap. It is multilingual. It also takes in people who are illiterate because they can speak to their phones. It is widely accessible. It is going to break down barriers that have existed, and those are barriers that were based on gender and cost and geography and income levels. And for all of those reasons, and because it's an everything device, it's not a one device, it is also a camera, it's also a TV, it's also a streaming device, it's a payment system, it's all of these things in one. For all of those reasons, I think it will end up being the most transformative, and I say that in a neutral sense, the most transformative thing in modern India's history. Much of it will be for good, some of it will be for bad.
Yeah, will it be a good thing or bad thing? Time will tell, right?
Exactly.
That brings us to the Asia Insider Minute, that part of the program where I do my best to sum up the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard. I also pose a few additional questions of my own and ask you, the listener, to share your thoughts as well. In many ways, India's concerns are the world's concerns. The smartphone, says Ravi, is either, and I quote, an agent for change or a weapon of mass destruction. Like any new technology, how it's applied and deployed determines the relative positive or negative effect it has. In India, the smartphone is that technology. In the hands of the curious, the inspired, or the entrepreneurial, it could mark a windfall moment for a nation that has long aspired but oftentimes fallen short of its grand ambitions. In the hands of infants, megalomaniacs, or promulgators of fake news, it could prove the unwinding of the world's largest democracy, a country held together by the promise of economic growth and wealth creation for all. When you think about it, India's ability to keep it together as a single nation these past 70 years is nothing short of miraculous. Socially, religiously, and culturally, it remains the most diverse nation on earth. There are 22 major languages in India, written in 13 different scripts with over 720 dialects. The country is carved into 36 states and union territories, and while there are just 7 nationally recognized political parties, there are all told more than 1,800 registered parties with their own set of micro-issues and concerns. Observing the thousands of political alliances required to hold the country together is like watching a three-dimensional episode of Game of Thrones. And still, the nation survives. This brings us back to smartphones. It has the ability to transform the way consumers communicate, transact, and educate themselves. It also serves as a portal to social and political subject matter that might easily offend the sensibilities of villagers who up until now have lived in relative isolation and focused mostly on local affairs. We've discussed the promise and peril of social media on previous episodes, but in the case of India, what might happen if the Revolutionary Socialist Party of West Bengal harnesses social media to threaten the Jan Shakti Party of Punjab, setting off a war of words? Maybe nothing. Then again, the world has seen how obscure and inane postings can electrify and divide nations. Think Trump on Twitter. But let's come back to Ravi's suggestion that the smartphone is to India what the automobile was to America. In 1917, Detroit had more cars on its streets than any other city in the world. There were 65,000 automobiles choking the streets and over 7,000 accidents. That's like buying a gas stove for your kitchen with a 1 in 8 chance that it's going to blow up. In the beginning, at least, cars were killing machines. Only by imposing laws and training drivers was Detroit able to reduce fatalities. 100 years later, last I checked, there were no laws governing the use of smartphones. I'm not suggesting there should be, but a bit of etiquette and social responsibility might go a long way in reducing social media fatalities. What do you think? Leave us a comment, download the episode, or better yet, reach us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We promise to respond responsibly. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.